From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, using the boombox for social change, we talk with Bill Siemering, a pioneer in public radio in the U.S. He's now helping to develop community radio stations in emerging democracies. He says radio is often the most important medium in new democracies. Also today, the Flaming Groovies. We talk with the band's co-founder, Roy Loney. The band started in San Francisco in the late 60s, playing a kind of punkish pop that didn't fit into the psychedelic scene. Two of their albums have been reissued. And film critic John Powers reviews Albert Brooks' new movie, The Muse. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Attorney General Janet Reno pledged today to find out why it took the FBI 6 years to disclose that agents fired flammable tear gas grenades at the Branch Davidian siege near Waco, Texas. The FBI has acknowledged that its agents may have fired at least two pyrotechnic tear gas canisters at a bunker near the religious sect's compound on the final day of the 51-day siege. The compound later burned down, killing sect leader David Koresh and some 80 of his followers. Reno said that she'd been assured that no pyrotechnic devices were used. The British minister responsible for Northern Ireland says the ceasefire is still intact. Unionists had accused the Irish Republican Army of breaking the agreement by being involved in a murder. Jennifer Glass reports from London.
Britain's Northern Ireland Secretary Mo Mollam admits the peace is flawed and that serious issues need to be addressed, but she sees no indication that the IRA is returning to organized violence. She acknowledged allegations that the IRA was involved in gun running from the United States, as well as a high-profile murder in Northern Ireland, and says she came very close to invalidating the ceasefire. Her decision not to has come under fire from unionists and opposition politicians here, who believe the IRA is in clear breach of the peace agreement. They say the IRA has gotten away with murder and question what it has to do to break the ceasefire. It seems Mollam had little choice but to uphold the peace deal, an imperfect peace, she says, is better than none. Jennifer Glass, NPR News, London.
Hurricane Dennis is about 200 miles east-southeast of Nassau in the Bahamas. Dennis is creeping its way up the island chain of the Bahamas with winds of 80 miles per hour, but it's keeping a safe distance so far. Ed Thompson reports from Barbados.
There is a chance now that Dennis will not make a direct hit on any of the islands of the Bahamas. The island that stands the greatest probability of an encounter with the storm is Eleuthera, due east of Nassau. Dennis could miss Eleuthera by about 40 miles early Friday. And a separate weather system, which is sweeping across the United States, could keep Dennis away from the Carolinas and the rest of the U.S. coast this weekend. Still, the National Hurricane Center is advising the Carolinas to pay close attention to the storm's progress. What was Tropical Storm Emily has been downgraded to a tropical depression with winds of 35 miles per hour. That lessens the possible threat to the Leeward Islands of the Caribbean. And Hurricane Cindy has strengthened. It now has winds of 85 miles per hour, but it is about 800 miles southeast of Bermuda and far from any landmass. For NPR News, I'm Ed Thompson in Barbados.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 128 points to close at 11,198. Declining issues led advances by 3-2 in moderate trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 709 million shares. This is NPR. The Chicago Cubs' Sammy Sosa has hit his 53rd home run, putting him two homers ahead of Mark McGwire in Major League Baseball's home run race. Sosa connected on a pitch from the San Francisco Giants' Levan Hernandez in the fifth inning of the game in Chicago. Sosa is now 9 games ahead of his pace last year when he hit a total of 66 homers and finished behind McGwire's record-setting 70. A receiver for the Miami Dolphins has been acquitted of money laundering charges. Tony Martin had been accused of helping a childhood friend cover up the origin of drug money. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports from Miami.
A federal jury in Miami returned its verdict this afternoon after deliberating for 2 days. The jury found Tony Martin innocent on all counts, but his friend, convicted drug dealer Ricky Brownlee, was found guilty. The two men were charged with using proceeds from drug sales to buy luxury cars and other expensive items. Brownlee allegedly furnished the money to Martin, then reimbursed him in cash. Martin, who was signed by the Dolphins this year after helping the Atlanta Falcons win the Super Bowl, said he saw his football career flashing before his eyes as the verdicts were read. He pledged to be more strict with himself in the future. Among Martin's character witnesses were Dolphin teammates, including quarterback Dan Marino. Cheryl Duvall, NPR News, Miami.
Afghanistan's ruling Taliban faction said today that terrorists used sophisticated technology in a bomb aimed at its supreme leader, Mullah Mohammad Omar. Omar was not hurt. A spokesman said the attack was part of a plot against the Taliban movement by enemies, but he declined to be specific. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Bill Siemering, was one of the architects of National Public Radio. He was NPR's first director of programming. He wrote the network's first mission statement and created All Things Considered. I had the pleasure of working with him in the 80s when he was station manager at WHYY, where Fresh Air is produced. For the past few years, Siemering has been taking his vision of radio to emerging democracies, places like South Africa, Mozambique, and Mongolia, where radio used to be controlled by the state, or where the society was so low-tech few people had radios. Siemering started this work in 1993 when he received a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship. Now he works with the Soros Foundation's Open Society Institute. His work ranges from training journalists to bringing transmitters to fledgling stations. Bill Siemering says radio is often the most important form of communication in new democracies.
In the first place, these are countries that are quite poor and couldn't afford to have television or newspapers. Many of the people are illiterate. Distribution of newspapers is difficult. And so radio is the most important medium.
Set the scene for us. I mean, describe a couple of very low-tech places where people rely on radio for information and for connection.
In Mozambique, I went out into a rural village where some of the youngsters had not seen a white person before. And we were there to gather information about what their interests were, what their needs were for radio. Some of them have not been to a store to make a purchase for maybe 5 years. They are subsistence farmers that are just bartering. And so some of them, many of them don't have radio to begin with and didn't really know about radio, or the language or the broadcasts they could hear were in Portuguese and not in their own language. So this was a very isolated kind of situation, but they were very much in need of health information, where you have high incidence of sexually transmitted diseases, for example, or poor nutrition, really preventable diseases that can be aided by just information. The other side of that would be in Mongolia, where you have the largest group of nomads in the world, and they're living, again, in very isolated areas in their gares, herding sheep and goats and horses and so on. And there's no other way for them to get information. So radio really is the most important medium in these countries.
In America, you know, I think most people rely on radio for time, temperature, news, traffic, and music. Mm-hmm. What are some of the more unusual programs that you've heard?
Well, some of the more unusual uses of it would be what is the price of animal skins, for example, for the nomads. Of course, weather is important there, but I think they're probably very skilled at reading their own weather signs. But weather certainly is important, but price, market prices. And in places like Mozambique, again, there's agricultural information. But most importantly, it's kind of development-oriented things. Even the simple thing about announcing deaths and funerals is important. I remember at one station in Mozambique, there were some, there was a small family gathered around the station. I said, why are they here? And they said, well, they've lost their family. They've gotten separated somehow. And the only place they knew to come was to the radio station to help to find them.
So the radio station isn't just like playing programs. It's like an active participant in the community.
Yes. That's one of the characteristics of these stations. They're not a passive transmitter of information. They're actively engaged with the community in the production of the programs, in getting feedback, in all aspects of it.
We asked you to bring in an excerpt of a broadcast from Mongolia. And what you've brought with you is a very kind of unusual broadcast. Maybe you can explain this for us and then play an excerpt.
This is a little piece that is heard on the state broadcasting. And it's unusual in that I think it's produced by somebody in Scotland where there's also Mongolian listening. So it's a way of Mongolians kind of learning some English and about music, pop music. And the other thing I would mention in here is it's sponsored by Nescafe, and Mongolians, they have a way of kind of slurping their coffee and tea or something. So that's why you hear this kind of funny sound.
And so this is not community radio.
This is not community. This is a state radio and a local station in Ulaanbaatar, Blue Sky Radio.
Coffee break. Coffee break. This cafe. Coffee tussle. Coffee tussle.
Hello there, and welcome to Nescafe Coffee Break on Blue Sky Radio. Brian and Balor in our studio in Scotland with all of our listeners together on Blue Sky today. It's nice to be with you.
Sambano.
Thank you. How do I say thank you? Bairla.
Bairla. Maybe it's better for you to pronounce Bairla.
Bairla.
Yeah. Double L.
Bairla. That sound is very difficult for Western people.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I think I'll stick to the music. Okay, The Backstreet Boys is what we're going to play today. One of the big songs of 1997. It's called As Long As You Love Me, and it's a good song.
Mm. 인게 오늘 네스카페가 선수시 텐데 저를 다니긴 독 선거든 이날로 Backstreet Boys 함께인 As Long As You Love Me. Do you know the meaning of the name of the band?
No, it probably means that they come from a poor area. If you say they're Backstreet, it means they come from a poor area.
Okay. 비 브랜드스 야가디 임니르트 올슨 гэж 썼은 чин Backstreet Boys 그래.
Bill, do you often hear Western pop music on the radio in Mongolia?
Yes. In fact, often I'm listening to the radio and I think it could be in America. It's only when I hear the back announce that I realize that it, of course, is not, because they have access in Ulaanbaatar to MTV on satellite. And so a lot of times their top 10 list will come off of MTV.
So I guess that's part of the reason why you need community radio.
And why you need community radio, yes, and ways of affirming the local culture.
Give me a sense of what you do. You fly into Mongolia, and then you head right to a radio station there. I mean, give me a sense of what your last trip to Mongolia was like.
My last trip to Mongolia was like this. I arrived on Friday and went to the foundation office.
Mm-hmm. Is the Soros Foundation?
The Soros office. Foundation, and. Met with my colleagues there, and Monday morning we got on the Trans-Siberian Railroad and traveled 10 hours north to the Russian border, where there was a small town, provincial capital, where a couple of women journalists wanted to start a radio station. And so we met with them. We had our business meeting, and they said, we need some inspiration, so let's go to the countryside and go to a high point that's closer to the sky and to the birds. And so we did that, because the Mongolians are very close to nature and very connected to that. And so this was a different kind of thing than you'd have as a business meeting here.
Yeah, I'll say.
We also went to visit what they called the mother tree, which has a legend around it that a mother with an infant was following a pilgrim in the winter, and she got lost and froze to death. And on that spot, a tree grew. And because of this, they felt that the area around that had special powers, particularly for women. And so women come and offer prayers, men and women, but it is particularly for women, for whatever. One of the journalists we were with had not been able to conceive a child, and she prayed to the mother tree, and she has two children now. Again, this isn't the typical kind of thing that you go out and do after a business meeting. We then took a train at 3 in the morning to another town where they were just starting a radio station, a UNESCO-sponsored station. And I did a workshop on what are the basics for starting a radio station.
Now, you've made several trips to South Africa in the past
few years.
And that's an area where the nature of broadcasting is really changing. It's not state-sponsored broadcasting anymore. Blacks in South Africa can have their own radio shows now, which is very new. It's just a post-apartheid phenomenon, I'd imagine.
Well, actually, during the days of apartheid, the South African Broadcasting Corporation did broadcast in the 11 languages, and Zulu is the most listened to program service there. But it was all state-controlled.
Right.
So there were certainly black Africans that were broadcasting, but they were following the government line.
What's happening on South African radio now in the post-apartheid era that couldn't have happened under apartheid?
Well, one of the things that we're really proud of is that there's been remarkably effective election coverage with all the different parties. There are about 26 different parties or so. And the community stations really did extraordinary good leadership in that. South African Broadcasting also was doing a remarkable job of that. And it's interesting because I was there during the first election in 94, and there were all kinds of Americans and Canadians there to teach people how to cover elections as if we knew. And now I would say that they could come here and teach us some things about how to run elections. I mean, there weren't, you know, attack ads. There weren't, they were focusing on issues and really a lot of community participation.
You've brought with you a tape excerpt of an early broadcast from a community radio station. Tell us about the tape that you've brought. Introduce it for us.
Yes. I had the privilege of being with a group of rural women that were wanting to start a radio station in 1994. And they were learning how to use a tape recorder and a microphone for the first time. And they broke up into small groups, about four groups, and produced little five-minute pieces, complete with their own songs and interviews and so on. And then they sat down and they played them and critiqued them. And there was this wonderful moment after this of this realization that they could do it. And they said, we can do this. This isn't so hard. And that's one of the beautiful things about radio. It really is so accessible and so easy to do. And they put on this programming. And this is what it sounded like.
Ba re tshwanetse go apewa 15 minutes fela e be gore wa e hlatlola o e fa ngwana a gago. Thobela ke a leboga. Go tla kena mmino. Mino, 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 mino. Mino,
mino. Mako tshile pishini. Mako tshile pishini. Mako tshile pishini.
It's an excerpt of a broadcast from rural South Africa. My guest is Bill Siemering, who's been traveling to emerging democracies around the world, helping people build community radio stations. Bill, it must be sometimes frustrating for you to hear this exciting stuff happening on the radio in languages that aren't English.
So right.
You don't know exactly what's being said.
That's right. I know that one of the issues that they talked a lot about was polygamy, which is a very serious issue for rural women because their husbands go to town to work in the mines and leave them in the countryside. And while they're in the city, they take another bride and they are left sometimes with fewer resources. So they were having, as one of their slogans, one man, one wife.
We'll talk more with Bill Siemering after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Siemering. He was NPR's first director of programming. Now he's working with radio stations in emerging democracies. You've had a lot of experience working with people in the United States who are starting in public radio or community radio, trying to kind of instill in them a sense of journalistic ethics and fairness and professionalism in front of the microphone. And I'm wondering if a lot of the standards that you've taught here in the United States are the same ones that you're trying to teach now in emerging democracies, or if things are different because the culture is different and the location is different.
Well, there certainly are basic principles in covering news and accuracy, fairness, and balance, for example, that apply all over. It's just like you operate with sterile instruments. That's kind of a given. And we talk about the importance of being able to trust what comes out of the radio speaker as you trust the water to be pure when you open the tap. But one of the issues that came up in South Africa early on was the idea of access, because their community radio is really part of the liberation struggle, giving a voice to the voiceless, and everyone has a right to be on the radio. And much of the training in the beginning days when I first went there was, using a boombox to produce radio. And so you have this terrible sounding click, click, click editing on cassette to cassette, which is hard to listen to. But when the stations went on air, they quickly found that the listeners were saying, you know, that presenter isn't very good. Why are they on the radio? And so I argued that not everyone has a right to be on the radio. I think the listeners have a right, all the listeners have a right to expect something worth listening to on the radio. And unless you are reaching out with some level of professionalism, with some degree of quality, good quality programming and presentation, you're not going to be serving the community.
It's interesting because it takes quality and makes it into a democratic principle as opposed to making it into an elitist principle.
Yes, and really that's all we were talking about. It was a matter of having, you know, there's a great deal of freshness to it because people have not used radio before. They don't know what you can't do with it. They don't run everything through a focus group. And there's some marvelous inventive things that come from this. In one station in South Africa near Cape Town called Radio Zibanele, which is in a vast township, 750,000 people living in a sandy plain. And Radio Zibanele has as its mission to improve the quality of the health of the community. And by that they mean not only the physical health, but the cultural health, the educational health, the environmental health. And Zibonelli means see for yourself. Here's the information, see for yourself. And it's a wonderful idea of self-help. It's the whole idea is no one's going to come down from heaven to clean this up or make this a nice place. It's up to us to do this ourselves. And so they do it. And they have in the mornings a remarkable program where listeners call up and tell their friends to wake up.
Excuse me?
So it'd be like, I would call up and say, tell Terry Gross to wake up. It's time to get to work. Huh. And so these messages go out. And it's kind of a wonderful way of creating community. It's a little maybe like Garrison Keillor talking about, you know, the messages, we'll be home, whatever, where you personalize a community that way. And it has the largest listenership, I think, of any station, any community station in South Africa.
Are there any aspects of your work now that remind you of when you were young and getting started in radio, working in public radio, I think, in Wisconsin?
Yes. My roots in public radio are very deep, because when I went to I know this sounds like a funny story, but when I went to a two-room country school in Wisconsin, I learned about science and social studies, music and art, all on radio by listening to the Wisconsin School of the Air. And now in Mongolia, we're talking about maybe a Mongolia School of the Air, where there can be actual instructional programs for isolated schools in rural areas. So there is a parallel there.
When you come home, do you see democracy in the United States or radio in the United States in a different way than you did before you started this work?
Yes, I came back once, and I remember some people were saying, boy, this Rush Limbaugh, I mean, gee, something ought to be done about him. And I said, whoa, I mean, this is a free society, you know? That's what democracy is about, whether you like him or not. You know, it's instructive, and it's what we're doing here. You can't very well come back and say, you know, take that kind of line when you're encouraging people overseas to have a free and open discussion of ideas. And it's a little discouraging just to find things so kind of carefully formatted and so limited in a way that there's not this same spirit of experimentation and fun and trying things that I see overseas in the new democracies. One of the things that I enjoy about working overseas is that all the people nearly that I work with are very young. Radio is a medium of the young people. And this is the new generation that's kind of taking over in the countries. And so they're full of new ideas and enthusiasm for radio as a medium, storytelling, creative uses of it that we haven't done so much of here lately. And so this is very heartening to me. And when I do workshops, I frequently end by pointing out that in English, the original meaning of broadcast was to scatter seeds. And I ask them what their meaning of broadcast is, and it tends to be similar. And I love that image of scattering seeds, because I think that's what we as broadcasters do. We scatter seeds of information, of ideas that grow. Some of them don't grow, but that's what we offer for our listeners.
Well, Bill Siemering, thank you very much, and good luck in your travels around the world.
Thank you.
Bill Siemering works with the Soros Foundation's Open Society Institute, helping community radio stations in emerging democracies. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from Time Magazine, this week, Caring for Aging Parents, a guide to navigating this rite of passage, which has become commonplace for countless American families. Additional support from Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. And from petopia.com, offering food, advice, toys, treats, and supplies delivered to pets and their people nationwide. On the web at petopia.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the Flaming Groovies. We meet Roy Loney, co-founder of the band that started in San Francisco in the mid-60s, playing music that didn't fit into the psychedelic scene. Two of the band's records have been reissued. And film critic John Powers reviews the Albert Brooks comedy, The Muse. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is a good time to catch up on the music of an influential cult band, the Flaming Groovies. Now they're seen as a forerunner of punk rock, but a lot of people didn't know what to make of them in the 60s when they were a San Francisco-based band that wasn't playing psychedelic music. Their early records didn't sell well, but they later became highly sought after. Two Flaming Groovies records have just been reissued, Flamingo and Teenage Head. My guest Roy Loney co-founded the band in 1965 and was its main songwriter, lead singer, and guitarist until he left in 1971. Let's start with Yesterday's Numbers from Teenage Head.
Have you ever been in love? So long it couldn't end. Did you ever break a heart, baby? What have you? Or did you ever lose a friend? Baby, I want your love tonight to make my head feel light. Oh, baby, won't you sell me now? Baby, tell me it's all right. Tell me it's all right.
Roy Loney, welcome to Fresh Air.
Pleasure to be here.
Do you think listeners will hear the Flaming Groovies differently now in the late 1990s than they did in, say, the late 60s? Do you think that, given everything that's happened musically since the Flaming Groovies, that the early records will sound different now?
Yeah, I do. I think back then people didn't really expect us to sort of, you know, we weren't exactly like everything else that was going on at the time. We were a little outside, you know, especially out of the San Francisco scene. You know, it was the psychedelic era. We were just playing these little two-minute songs. We were considered kind of an oldies band, actually, which we never understood. But we were rooted in roots rock and roll. And we just didn't... you know, we didn't sort of fit in with what was going on at the time, and we had a great cult following, always have, but I think now we sound a little more mainstream than we did back then.
Well, I think it's easy to hear the band now, too, as being a kind of forerunner of punk and roots-oriented new wave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. A lot of people have called this the godfathers of punk, which at first kind of, you know, I couldn't understand, but I can sort of see it. I mean, I think... mainly with the song Teenage Head, I think, is that's where they, you know, got that from.
Well, why don't we play some of Teenage Head?
Great.
And this is from one of the albums that has just been reissued called Teenage Head.
I'm a monster. Got a ripped up teenage head.
Roloni, one of the lines in Teenage Head, a song you wrote, is, I'm a monster, got a revved up teenage head. How
right.
does that song sound to you now that you're far from teenagerdom?
Well, you know, I still sing that song every time I perform. I've kind of gotten past thinking about it, you know. I mean, I actually put an album out about 2 years ago called Full Grown Head, which sort of, you know, got me up to date. But yeah, no, I have no problem singing it. And I it was always a tongue-in-cheek song. It was always meant to be funny. So, you know, I never had a problem with it. I still don't. I love singing it, actually.
Who are some of the early rockers who had the biggest influence on you and who's still, whose work you still really love?
Well, Elvis, of course. It was a big breakthrough for me. I was just a little kid when he did the first Tommy Dorsey show, Dorsey Brothers TV show, and that just knocked me out, knocked me for a loop. And Chuck Berry, big, big influence on me as a guitar player and songwriter. Little Richard, Fats Domino. Eddie Cochran was real big for me. A lot of people have compared my singing style to Eddie Cochran, and I can really see that because he was a big, big influence on me back then.
Now, you mentioned Elvis Presley, of course.
Yeah.
And one of your songs, Evil Hearted Ada,
oh, yeah,
is a kind of humorous homage to Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
With, you know, a lot of, like, the reverb and the kind of
right.
Elvis hiccuping type of
right.
sound.
As much Elvis and Carl Perkins and just the Sun Records sort
sure.
of rockabilly sound.
Talk a little bit about recording this and what you were going for.
Well, we went in the studio and we had this Echoplex unit, which at the time was, you know, kind of unique. Most people weren't using them. We were. And it's like a repeat. It just causes a repeat of the vocal sound. And we use it on our guitars, and we decided to use it on the vocal, too, and see if we could get a Sun Records sort of slapback sound. So we, you know, tried it, loved the way it sounded, and then there's this whole section in the middle of the song during the lead break, the guitar solo, where I just kind of go nuts
right.
and make as many weird noises as I can and, you know, play off the effects. And I sort of did that one take. The band didn't even get to hear it until I had recorded it, and they came in, and everybody just fell apart laughing because it is, you know, it's just sort of, here's every cliched, you know, echo effect you've ever heard in your life, all in about a, you know, half a minute.
Well, let's hear an excerpt of it.
She's in orbit of your island. She's in orbit of the dawn. Don't let her take you by surprise. She can't pull away the floor. Oh,
That's the Flaming Groovies from a just reissued CD called Teenage Head. And the song we just heard was written and sung by my guest Roy Loney, who was the lead singer and guitarist with the Flaming Groovies. The Flaming Groovies were performing in the 60s, based in San Francisco, at the height of the psychedelic music era. As you were
yeah.
saying, you didn't really fit into that,
no.
Being more influenced by roots rock than psychedelic rock. What was your experience of the San Francisco music scene of the 60s?
Oh, it was... It turned me around. I remember going into the film auditorium the very first time with some friends. And we weren't doing psychedelics or even smoking pot at that point. We were drinking beer, you know. And we went in there late one night and saw, I think it was the Jefferson Airplane and the Quicksilver Messenger Service. And we were just knocked out. Couldn't believe it. It was so loud and so, like nothing we'd ever heard before. It totally blew my mind and made me want to do it. You know, to that point, I had been a folk singer for a long time and had thought about putting a rock band together, but I think seeing the San Francisco bands really turned a corner for us.
But you weren't doing the long jams of, say, the Grateful
No,
Dead.
That's the one thing.
You weren't doing the politicized lyrics of
no,
the Jefferson
you know,
Airplane.
No, we just never got into that. And so we never really fit in. I mean, it was like, I think everybody thought of us as they're sort of like funny little brothers, you know, who never kind of, we're serious. We never, you know, we're taking all that seriously back then because we did these little 2-minute songs. We didn't take a stance. We didn't, it was all very good humored. Humor was like a main part of our sound. Fun. Basically, it was fun what we were looking to do. And no politics, no long psychedelic jams, no blues, no folk rock, just basic rock and roll.
Now, the two albums that were just reissued have been out of circulation. What's it like for you to have them back in print? on CD?
Oh, it's great. You know, I think, you know, they've been available, like, on import and stuff for a long time. They haven't been totally out of print. They just haven't been available domestically. And, you know, since we're a band who never sold record one in our time, you know, we're basically had a small cult following but never really sold any amount of records. I think it's great that it shows that they actually think the music is good.
Now, you've mentioned how little the Flamin' Groovies sold in terms of record sales. There's actually an ad that has been released on a collection of alternate takes and outtakes and unreleased material called Flamin' Groovies California Born and Bred. And it has an ad for your first commercially available record, you know. Uh-huh. And I thought we could hear that ad.
Oh, that'd be great.
Wait, Mr. Record Store Owner, what is that fantastically funky, outrageous, super socceroo, heavy, 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 trippy, zippy, too much, and altogether out of sight records you're playing? Turn it off! Turn it off! I can't stop dancing! That's better. What was that paradise for rock and rollers?
Of course you couldn't stop dancing, young man. That was the Flamin' Groovies on their new epic album, Super Snazz. A truly funky experience.
Too much? I can't live another moment without owning my very own copy of that snazzy item.
Yes, I have several of them.
All right, that makes five copies. Hey, wait a minute. Aren't you fellas the Flamin' Groovies?
Yes.
And don't forget, boys and girls, the Flamin' Groovies will be performing this weekend along with Commander Cody, Phoenix, and Rainbow Jam Light Show at the old Fillmore Auditorium, Fillmore and Geary. That's Friday and Saturday, October 10th and 11th. Admission only $1. Can you beat that?
Well, Roy Loney, the end of that promotes a concert at the Fillmore with a light show and everything. Did you perform with light shows a lot?
All the time, oh sure.
What was that like?
It was great. I mean, you were being entertained as much as you were entertaining, you know. I mean, it was like just like putting you in a different world, putting you in a good space. It got crazy at times. You couldn't see across the stage half the time, but I enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. I think it's more fun when you're out in the audience watching it than it is when you're in the middle of it.
My guest is Roy Loney, co-founder of the Flamin' Groovies. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Roy Loney, who co-founded the Flamin' Groovies in 1965 and left the band in 1971. He was the main songwriter, lead singer, and guitarist. Two of their CDs have just been reissued. You left the Flamin' Groovies in 1971. Why did you leave?
That was a lot of different reasons. I was losing interest. After we put out the Teenage Head album, and it got great reviews, it just didn't sell at all. The band was a little bit down. I was, I think, maybe the most down. Just kind of losing interest all around in the business. And I think at that point also, Cyril was sort of moving in different directions musically. He wanted to...
Cyril's the other guitarist with the band.
Yeah, he was the lead guitar player. And he and I wrote all the songs together, pretty much. And I think it came to a point where he sort of wanted to run the band. He wanted to take it in a new direction. And it was a direction I wasn't really leaning towards. And like I said, I was somewhat, I don't know, disenchanted with the whole business. So I think it was just, you know, a natural parting of the ways.
I hope you don't mind. I'm going to read a quote that Cyril said about you. This is from a 1979 fanzine interview.
Oh, I think I know it's coming.
Yes, it's on the internet. I'll just read an excerpt from this. He says, Roy wouldn't keep up with the style, the mode of dress that we were into, the velvet coats or whatever. So acting like Jagger in white California Levi's and tennis shoes seemed weird. Basically, all it did was turn all these hip people off to the band. What do you think of... Is that an accurate description? You're acting like Jagger and tennis shoes?
I always dressed that way. I mean, I was definitely a tennis shoe kind of guy. I wasn't never wearing the crushed velvet coats and, you know, or riding jackets or anything. I never went into that, the sort of Beau Brummels look. Uh-huh. But actually, you know, the Groovies when I left, hadn't got into that area particularly either. I mean, it wasn't until long after I was gone that they sort of moved into the sort of the Beatle-y mod look. But yeah, I never dressed for the occasion. You know, I always just wanted to be comfortable.
When you left the band continued without you and, you know, went through changes of its
right.
own. Did you spend a lot of time listening to the band afterwards, or did you not even want to think about it after you left?
No, I had no problem with it. When I first left the band, they decided to change the name. They didn't think they could call it the Flamin' Groovies without me, so they called themselves the Dawgs. And but they couldn't get booked as the Dawgs, so they had to go back to the Flamin' Groovies because it did have a little bit of a name value. And the first song they ever recorded after I left was a thing called Slow Death, which I co-wrote with Cyril. So they were still sort of sticking to my sound. The first two singles they did at United Artists were very much the original groovy sound that I was part of. It wasn't until the Shake Some Action album where they kind of moved into their new direction, the sort of the Mercy Beat, Beatles sort of sound. And I liked it. The first time I heard the Shake Some Action sides, I thought they were great. And I was really proud of Cyril. I thought he really done a great job.
You didn't play, I understand, for about 8 years after leaving the band?
Yeah, I, like I said, I was sort of fed up with the music business, just sort of tired of the whole thing. So I sort of dropped out. I actually went to work for a record label. I worked for ABC Records, the now defunct ABC Records, for several years. I got married. I moved to Marin County, decided to be, you know, just sort of a regular guy. But it was not to be. I guess I just can't be a regular guy. It lasted a while. It lasted longer than I thought it would. But during that whole period, I was writing songs. I never stopped writing songs. So when I finally came out of that, I had about 200 songs, and I was ready to go back and do some recording.
Do you still like to perform?
Love it. You know, I started off as an actor. That's what I always considered myself an actor who did a little singing on the side, pretty much. And I've always felt that my stage show was more of a performance than a concert. I always think of myself as a performer rather than a singer. So yeah, it's my lifeblood. It's what I do. I can't not do it. I think I'd be violently ill if I couldn't perform.
Well, given your acting background and your sense of it being a performance when you're on stage, do you think that you become a different character?
I become a different character with every song. You know, it's like a lot of the songs I write are from a point of view of a character, and I think I get into that character every time I do that song. I'm kind of a method singer, I guess.
A method singer-songwriter.
Yeah, there you go.
Now, do you work in a record store now part-time?
Yeah, I actually manage Jack's Record Cellar, which is the oldest running record store here in San Francisco. It's been around since about 53.
Is it used, or?
Yeah, it's like we have a lot of 78s, 45s, LPs. It's vinyl, not too much in the way of CDs. We're keeping analog, pretty much. And 78s is our big thing. People really love the sound of 78s. I don't know if you've ever heard a mint 78, but it sounds better than anything. It sounds better than any CD or LP.
You have a turntable that has a 78 function
yep,
on it?
Yep, sure do. Uh-huh. You can still get them.
So do you like being surrounded by records?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I guess I'm spoiled. I mean, I'm around great records all the time, and that's, you know, all day long I just listen to music. You know, that's my job, and I love it. I love it. And I think that's why I like all kinds of music, because I'm just constantly listening to new stuff, old stuff. And I just, it's the job for me, totally.
People envy me. When you see somebody, you know, buying a whole bunch of either interesting or really perplexing records, do you say anything to them? Just ever strike up conversations with the customers?
Not really. I mean, yes, I do sometimes. I mean, people have wide ranges of our, you know, interest, obviously. The people come in and all they want is Paul Peterson, or they only collect, you know,
they
only
collect. From the Donna Reed
Show. Yeah, exactly. That's all they collect.
Wait, what was his hit?
My Dad. It's called My Dad. Uh-huh. He had one big hit. And then, you know, Patty Duke had records. There's people who collect just odd things, you know, and that's their whole shtick, you know. And then there are people who collect a little bit of everything. And the 78 people are especially that way. They, you know, they tend to be all over the map. But no, I don't ever make derogatory comments about what they're buying. I used to, when I was younger and kind of a punk, I would always say, "You're not really buying that, are you?" You know. But no, I'm very cool about it. And I just think music is a great, it's the great communicator. And I think if it communicates to you, it's great.
And what has a lot of cachet now that had none when when you first started performing?
Oh, I think, you know, Bing Crosby. You know, early Bing Crosby, a lot of people have turned on to. You know, there was a time when you'd say Bing Crosby was sort of like that meant, you know, dead and past and gone and, you know, completely not happening. But early Bing Crosby was pretty swinging and jazzy. And,
well, especially the Rhythm Boys era.
Oh, yeah, that, exactly. That stuff is great, I think.
And yeah, I think
a
so
lot
too.
Of young people are turning on to it. And I think it's good. It's healthy.
Well, I want to thank you, Rolone, very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Rolone co-founded the Flaming Groovies. Two of their CDs have just been reissued, Flamingo and Teenage Head. Coming up, John Powers reviews Albert Brooks' new film, This is Fresh Air. The Muse is a new comedy opening this week, written, directed, and starring Albert Brooks. It's a satire of the movie business and co-stars Sharon Stone as The Muse. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
Over the last 20 years, our best comic filmmaker has been Albert Brooks. His finest movies, Modern Romance, Lost in America, and Mother, have made him Hollywood's most trenchant chronicler of upper middle class life. With its love of German cars, yammering self-absorption, and touching attempts to escape the compulsive patterns that are the human equivalent of a Skinner box. But while his films are classics, they're increasingly out of fashion in an industry that wants comedies like American Pie or Big Daddy. This depressing reality forms the backdrop for The Muse, which spins bright laughter out of showbiz disillusionment. Brooks stars as Stephen Phillips, a veteran screenwriter who begins the movie receiving a prestigious Hollywood Prize for humanitarianism. The very next day, he's fired from his studio gig by a slithery executive who claims he's lost his edge. Desperate to save his career, he runs to get help from his bronzed, Oscar-winning friend Jack, played by Jeff Bridges. Incredibly, Jack says he owes his success to a muse named Sarah. That's Sharon Stone. Sarah's the actual daughter of the Greek god Zeus, who gets people in touch with their creativity. She agrees to take on the frantic Stephen as a client, but she does expect a few things in return, like gifts from Tiffany's and a $1,700-a-day suite at the Four Seasons. Soon, the moody muse has taken over Stephen's life, calling at midnight to demand Waldorf salad and threatening his precarious masculinity by encouraging his stay-at-home wife, that's Annie McDowell, to pursue her dream of becoming the next Mrs. Fields. Brooks is our shrewdest observer of L.A. delusion, and the muse glitters with an insider's bemusement at Hollywood's penchant for believing in supernatural quick fixes. It also paints a hilariously nasty portrait of the glib, know-nothing young men who now run the film business, as in the early scene when an exec takes Stephen to lunch to discuss his new script.
I read your script.
And?
Well, let me put this in a form that isn't insulting, because I tend to be too direct. All my friends tell me that. The script's no good.
That's the form that's not insulting? What would the insulting form be?
Oh, good one.
What are you doing?
Oh, I write down lines I like. I like that line.
Yeah, I think that's called stealing. So just cut to the chase. Just what exactly are you telling me?
We'd like you out of here by 5.
What?
It would really help us out. Brian De Palma needs your office.
Well, you can't give Brian De Palma my office.
Well, it's not really your office. I mean, we're all just using space here. You know, I'm where Lucille Ball used to be.
Huh. Too bad you're not where she is now.
Good one.
You write that down, I'll cut off your hand.
While Brooks's Hollywood jokes are uproarious, the idea of having a muse is potentially far richer. And Brooks turns it into a wittily accurate portrait of the unruly workings of creativity. Just as artists must bend their whole lives in the search for inspiration, keeping mad hours, cutting themselves off from loved ones, lubricating their libidos with liquor. So Stephen discovers that the muse is a capricious benefactor. She may free his imagination to write that Jim Carrey summer blockbuster, but she also makes him slave to her desire to have her walls repainted or to sleep in his marital bed. In early films, like Modern Romance, Brooks pushed his ideas so far it drove most viewers crazy. Here, he doesn't push far enough. We keep waiting for Stephen's relationship to the muse to take us somewhere wild and revelatory, but the movie lacks his usual precise structure. Maybe Brooks' own muse abandoned him in the second half of the script. Maybe he thinks he's indulging the audience's desire for comedies that are merely a grab bag of jokes. Or maybe he's simply dispirited by the stardom of Adam Sandler. Whatever the reason, Brooks remains content to string together terrifically sharp bits, from an absurdly futile tennis match between Stephen and Jack to an uproarious cameo by adrenaline-powered Martin Scorsese, who, like James Cameron and Rob Reiner, is shown paying Tiffany tribute to the muse. Brooks also gets a spirited performance from Stone, who clearly relishes playing a divine diva and flounces through the movie in fluttery turquoise outfits. She's a born comedian who never seems to do comedy, and I haven't seen her look so relaxed in ages. Brooks has recently married and had a child, and now that his personal life has grown happier, his on-screen persona seems to be calmer, less feverishly solipsistic. Here, he's even playing a family man. But while The Muse is his slightest and most parochial film, this time he's lost in Hollywood, not in America, it made me laugh in ways that only he can. That's why you won't catch me accusing Albert Brooks of losing his edge.
Joan Powers is film critic for Vogue and Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Sharuk. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Cherie Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Back Bay Books, publishers of The Pilot's Wife, a novel by Anita Shreve, in paperback in bookstores everywhere. From the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture. And from Bantam Books, publishers of Victory in Our Schools by Major General John Stanford, a book outlining his essentials for improving our schools. Available in trade paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we go back into the archives for some memorable interviews from the past. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.